with offers and inducements. However, each college required a $10 non-returnable entrance fee sent with the application. I had exactly $10, so I could apply only to one. Looking back, I realized that I could have borrowed the money to make several applications, or it's possible that if I'd talked to representatives from the schools, they might have waived the fee. But my mother had pushed the concept of self-reliance for so long, I didn't want to start out owing a school just to get accepted. At that time, the University of Michigan, a spectacular school and always in the top 10 academically and in sports events, actively recruited black students. And the University of Michigan waived the fees for in-state students who couldn't afford to pay. However, I wanted to attend college farther away. I looked hard at my future, knowing that I could get into any of the top schools, but not knowing what to do. Graduating third in my class, I had excellent SAT scores, and most of the top colleges were scrambling to enroll blacks. After college, with a major in pre-med and a minor in psychology, I'd be ready for medical school, and at last, on the real road toward becoming a doctor. For a long time, it bothered me that I had graduated third in my senior high school class. It's probably a character flaw, but I can't help myself. It wasn't that I had to be first in everything, but I should have been number one. If I hadn't gotten so sidetracked by the need for peer approval, I would have been at the head of my class. In thinking toward college, I determined that would never happen again. From now on, I'd be the best student I was capable of being. Several weeks flew by as I struggled over which college to send my application to, and by late spring I had narrowed the choice between Harvard and Yale. Either would have been great, which made the decision difficult. Strangely enough, my final decision hinged on a television program. As I watched College Bowl one Sunday night, the Yale students wiped the Harvard students off the face of the map with a fantastic score of something like 510-35. That game helped me to make my decision. I wanted to go to Yale. In less than a month, I not only had my acceptance at Yale to enter in the fall of 1969, but they offered me a 90% academic scholarship. I suppose I should have been elated by the news. I was happy, but not surprised. Actually, I took it calmly and perhaps even a bit arrogantly, reminding myself that I had already accomplished just about everything I'd set out to do. A high scholastic record, top SAT scores, every kind of high school recognition possible, along with my long list of achievements with the ROTC program. Campus accommodations befitted students of my stature. The student housing was luxurious, the rooms more like suites. The suites included a living room, fireplace, and built-in bookcases. Bedrooms branched off from the main room. 2 to 4 students shared each suite. I had a room to myself. I strode onto the campus, looked up at the tall, Gothic-style buildings, and approved of the ivy-covered walls. I figured I'd take the place by storm, and why not? I was incredibly bright. After less than a week on campus, I discovered I wasn't that bright. All the students were bright, many of them extremely gifted and perceptive. Yale was a great leveler for me, because I now studied, worked, and lived with dozens of high-achieving students, and I didn't stand out among them. One day, I was sitting at the dining room table with several class members who were talking about their SAT scores. One of them said, "I blew the SAT test with a total of just a little over 1,500 in both parts." "That's not too bad," another one sympathized. "Not great, but not bad." "What did you get?" the first student asked him. "Oh, 1,540 or 1,550 total. I can't remember my exact math score." It seemed perfectly natural to all of them to have scores in the high 90 percentile. I kept silent, realizing that I ranked lower than every student sitting around me. It was my first awareness of not being quite as bright as I thought, and the experience washed away a little of my cockiness. At the same time, the incident only slightly deterred me. It would be simple enough to show them. I'd do what I did at Southwestern and throw myself completely into my studies, learning as much as possible. Then my grades would put me right up in the top echelon. But I quickly learned that the classwork at Yale was difficult, unlike anything I'd ever encountered at Southwestern High School. The professors expected us to have done our homework before we came to class, then used that information as the basis for the day's lectures. This was a foreign concept to me. I'd slid through semester after semester in high school, studying only what I wanted, and then, being a good crammer, spent the last few days before exams memorizing like mad. It had worked at Southwestern. It was a shock to realize it wouldn't work at Yale. Each day I slipped farther and farther behind in my classwork, especially in chemistry. Why I didn't work to keep up, I'm not sure. I could give myself a dozen excuses, but they didn't matter. What mattered was that I didn't know what was going on in chemistry class. It all came to a head at the end of the first semester when I faced final examinations. The day before the exam, I wandered around the campus, sick with dread. I couldn't deny it any longer. I was failing freshman chemistry, and failing it badly. My feet scuffed through the golden leaves carpeting the wide sidewalks. Sunlight and shadow danced on ivy-covered walls. But the beauty of that autumn day mocked me. I'd blown it. I didn't have the slightest hope of passing chemistry because I hadn't kept up with the material. As the realization sunk in of my impending failure, this bright boy from Detroit also stared squarely into another horrible truth. If I failed chemistry, I couldn't stay in the pre-med program. Despair washed over me as memories of fifth grade flashed through my mind. "What score did you get, Carson? Hey, dummy, did you get any right today?" Years had passed, but I could still hear the taunting voices in my head. What am I doing at Yale anyway? It was a legitimate question, and I couldn't push the thought away. Who do I think I am? Just a dumb black kid from the poor side of Detroit who has no business trying to make it through Yale with all these intelligent, affluent students. I kicked a stone and sent it flying into the brown grass. "Stop it," I told myself. "You'll only make it worse." I turned my memories back to those teachers who told me, "Benjamin, you're bright. You can go places." There, walking alone in the darkness of my thoughts, I could hear Mother insist, "Benny, you can do it. Why, son, you can do anything you want, and you can do it better than anybody else. I believe in you." I turned and began walking between the tall, classic buildings back to the dorm. I had to study. "Stop thinking about failing," I told myself. "You can still pull this off. Maybe." I looked up through a scatter of fluttering leaves silhouetted against the rosy autumn sunset. Doubts niggled at the back of my mind. Finally, I turned to God. "I need help," I prayed. "Being a doctor is all I've ever wanted to do, and now it looks like I can't. And Lord, I've always had the impression you wanted me to be a doctor. I've worked hard and focused my life that way, assuming that's what I was going to do. But if I fail chemistry, I'm going to have to find something else to do. Please help me know what else I should do." Back in my room, I sank down on my bed. Dusk came early, and the room was dark. The evening sounds of campus filled the quiet room. Cars passing, students' voices in the park below my window, gusts of wind rustling through the trees. Quiet sounds. I sat there, a tall, skinny kid, head in my hands. I had failed. I had finally faced a challenge I couldn't overcome. I was just too late. Standing up, I flipped on the desk lamp. "Okay," I said to myself as I paced my room. "I'm going to fail chemistry. So I'm not going to be a doctor. Then what is there for me?" No matter how many other career choices I considered, I couldn't think of anything else in the whole world I wanted more than being a doctor. I remembered the scholarship offer from West Point. A teaching career? Business? None of these areas held any real interest. My mind reached toward God, a desperate yearning, begging, clinging to Him. "Either help me understand what kind of work I ought to do, or else perform some kind of miracle and help me to pass this exam." From that moment on, I felt at peace. I had no answer. God didn't break through my haze of depression and flash a picture in front of me. Yet I knew that whatever happened, everything was going to be all right. One glimmer of hope, a tiny one at that, shone through my seemingly impossible situation. Although I had been holding on to the bottom rung of the class from the first week at Yale, the professor had a rule that might save me. If failing students did well on the final exam, the teacher would throw out most of the semester's work and let the good final test score count heavily toward the final grade. That presented the only possibility for me to pass chemistry. It was nearly 10 p.m., and I was tired. I shook my head, knowing that between now and tomorrow morning I couldn't pull off that kind of miracle. "Ben, you have to try," I said aloud. "You have to do everything you can." I sat down for the next 2 hours and pored through my thick chemistry textbook, memorizing formulas and equations that I thought might help. No matter what happened during the exam, I would go into it determined to do the best I could. I'd fail, but, I consoled myself, at least I'd have a high fail. As I scribbled formulas on paper, forcing myself to memorize what had no meaning to me, I knew deep inside why I was failing. The course wasn't that tough. The truth lay in something much more basic. Despite my impressive academic record in high school, I really hadn't learned anything about studying. All the way through high school, I'd relied on the same old methods, wasting my time during the semester and then cramming for final exams. Midnight. The words on the pages blurred and my mind refused to take in any more information. I flopped into my bed and whispered in the darkness, "God, I'm sorry. Please forgive me for failing you and for failing myself." Then I slept. While I slept, I had a strange dream, and when I awakened in the morning, it remained as vivid as if it had actually happened. In the dream, I was sitting in the chemistry lecture hall, the only person there. The door opened, and a nebulous figure walked into the room, stopped at the board, and started working out chemistry problems. I took notes of everything he wrote. When I awakened, I recalled most of the problems, and I hurriedly wrote them down before they faded from memory. A few of the answers actually did fade, but still remembering the problems, I looked them up in my textbook. I knew quite a bit about psychology, so assumed I was still trying to work out unresolved problems during my sleep. I dressed, ate breakfast, and went to the chemistry lecture room with a feeling of resignation. I wasn't sure if I knew enough to pass, but I was numb from intensive cramming and despair. The lecture hall was huge, filled with individual fold-down wooden seats. It would seat about 1,000 students. In the front of the room, chalkboards faced us from a large stage. Also on the stage was a big desk with a countertop and sink for chemistry demonstrations. My steps sounded hollow on the wooden floor. The professor came in and, without saying much, began to hand out the booklets of examination questions. My eyes followed him around the room. It took him a while to pass out the booklets to 600 students. While I waited, I noticed the way the sun shone through the small panes of the arched windows along one wall. It was a beautiful morning to fail a test. At last, heart pounding, I opened the booklet and read the first problem. In that instant, I could almost hear the discordant melody that played on TV from the Twilight Zone. In fact, I felt I had entered that never-never land. Hurriedly, I skimmed through the booklet, laughing silently, confirming what I suddenly knew. The exam problems were identical to those written by the shadowy dream figure in my sleep. I knew the answer to every question on the first page. "Piece of cake," I mumbled as my pencil flew to write the solutions. The first page finished, I turned to the next page, and again, the first problem was one I had seen written on the board in my dream. I could hardly believe it. I didn't stop to analyze what was happening. I was so excited to know correct answers that I worked quickly, almost afraid I'd lose what I remembered. Near the end of the test, where my dream recall began to weaken, I didn't get every single problem. But it was enough. I knew I would pass. "God, you pulled off a miracle," I told him as I left the classroom. "And I make a promise to you that I'll never put you into that situation again." I walked around campus for over an hour, elated, yet needing to be alone, wanting to figure out what had happened. I never had a dream like that before. Neither had anyone I'd ever known. And that experience contradicted everything I'd read about dreams in my psychological studies. The only explanation just blew me away. The one answer was humbling in its simplicity. For whatever reason, the God of the universe, the God who holds galaxies in his hands, had seen a reason to reach down to a campus room on planet Earth and send a dream to a discouraged ghetto kid who wanted to become a doctor. I gasped at the sure knowledge of what had happened. I felt small and humble. Finally, I laughed out loud, remembering that the Bible records such events, though they were few, times where God gave specific answers and directions to his people. God had done it for me in the 20th century. Despite my failure, God had forgiven me and come through to pull off something marvelous for me. "It's clear that you want me to be a doctor," I said to God. "I'm going to do everything within my power to be one. I'm going to learn to study. I promise you that I'll never do this to you again." During my 4 years at Yale, I did backslide a little, but never to the point of not being prepared. I started learning how to study, no longer concentrating on surface material and just what the professors were likely to ask on finals. I aimed to grasp everything in detail. In chemistry, for instance, I didn't want to know just answers, but to understand the reasoning behind the formulas. From there, I applied the same principle to all my classes. After this experience, I had no doubt that I would be a physician. I also had the sense that God not only wanted me to be a physician, but that he had special things for me to do. I'm not sure people always understand when I say that, but I had an inner certainty that I was on the right path in my life, the path God had chosen for me. Great things were going to happen in my life, and I had to do my part by preparing myself and being ready. When the final chemistry grades came out, Benjamin S. Carson scored 97, right up there with the top of the class. Chapter 9. Changing the Rules. During my college years, I worked at several different summer jobs, a practice I had started in high school where I worked in the school laboratory. The summer between my junior and senior year of high school, I worked at Wayne State University in one of the biology laboratories. Between high school graduation and entering Yale, I needed a job badly. I had to have clothes for college, books, transportation money, and the dozens of other expenses I knew I'd face. One of the counselors at our high school, Alma Whitley, knew my predicament and was very understanding. One day I poured out my story and she listened with obvious concern. "I've got a few connections with the Ford Motor Company," she said. While I sat next to her desk, she phoned their world headquarters. I particularly remember her saying, "Look, we have this young fellow here named Ben Carson. He's very bright and already has a scholarship to go to Yale in September. Right now the boy needs a job to save money for this fall." She paused to listen, and I heard her add, "You have to give him a job." The person on the other end agreed. In the summer of 1988, Mrs. Whitley sent me a note that started out, "I wonder if you remember me." I was touched and tickled. Of course I remembered her, as I would have remembered anyone who had been that helpful to me. She said she had seen me on television and read articles about me. She is now retired, living in the South, and she wanted to send me her congratulations. I was delighted that she remembered me. The day after my last high school class, my name went on the list of employees at the Ford Motor Company in the main administration building in Dearborn. I worked in the payroll office, a job I considered prestigious, or as my mother called it, big time, because they required me to wear a white shirt and tie every day. That job taught me an important lesson about employment in the world beyond high school. Influence could get me inside the door, but my productivity and the quality of my work were the real tests. Just knowing a lot of information, while helpful, wasn't enough either. The principle goes like this. It's not what you know, but the kind of job you do that makes the difference. That summer I worked hard, as I did at every job, even the temporary ones. I determined that I would be the best person they had ever hired. After completing my first year at Yale, I received a wonderful summer job as a supervisor with the highway crew, the people who clean up the trash along the highways. The federal government had set up a jobs program, mostly for inner-city students. The crew walked along the interstate near Detroit in the western suburbs, picking up and bagging trash in an effort to keep the highways beautiful. Most of the supervisors had a horrible time with discipline problems, and the inner-city kids had hundreds of reasons for not putting any effort into their work. "It's too hot to work today," one would say. "I'm just too tired out from yesterday," another said. "Why we gotta do all this? Tomorrow people will just litter it all up again. Who'll know if we cleaned it up or not? Why should we kill ourselves at this? The job just doesn't pay enough to do that." The other supervisors, I learned, figured that if each of the 5 to 6 young men in the crew filled 2 plastic bags a day, they were doing well. These guys could do that much in 1 hour, and I knew it. I may be an overachiever, but it seemed a waste of my time to let my crew laze around picking up 12 bags of litter a day. From the first, my crew consistently filled between 100 and 200 bags a day, and we covered enormous stretches of highway. The amount of work my crew did flabbergasted my supervisors in the Department of Public Works. "How come your guys can get so much work done?" they asked. "None of the other crews do that much." "Oh, I have my little secrets," I'd say, and make a joke out of what I was doing. If I said too much, someone might interfere and make me change my rules. I used a simple method, but I didn't go by the standard procedures, and I share this story because I think it illustrates another principle in my life. It's like the popular song of a few years ago that says, "I did it my way." Not because I oppose rules, it would be crazy to do surgery without obeying certain rules, but sometimes regulations hinder and need to be broken or ignored. For example, the fourth day on the job, I said to my guys, "It's going to be real hot today." "You can say that again," one of them said, and immediately they all eagerly agreed. "So," I said, "I'm going to make you a deal. First, beginning tomorrow, we start at 6 in the morning while it's still cool. Man, nobody in the world gets up that early. Just listen to my whole plan," I said to the interrupter. Our crews were supposed to work from 7:30 a.m. until 4:30 p.m. with an hour off for lunch. "If you guys, and it has to be all 6 of you, will be ready to start work so that we can get out on the road at 6 and you work fast to fill up 150 bags, then after that, you're through for the day." Before anyone could start questioning me, I clarified what I meant. "You see, if you can collect all that trash in 2 hours, I'll take you back, and you're off the rest of the day. You still earn a full day's pay, but you have to bring in 150 bags no matter how long it takes." We bashed the idea back and forth, but they saw what I wanted. It had only taken a couple of days to get them to pick up 100 bags a day, and it was hot, hard work in the afternoon. But they loved taunting the other crews and telling how much they had done, and they were ready for the new challenge. These kids were learning to take pride in their work, as lowly as many of them considered their jobs. They agreed with my arrangement. The next morning, all 6 of them were ready to go at 6 a.m. And how they worked. Hard and fast. They learned to clean a whole stretch of highway in 2 to 3 hours, the same amount of work that they had previously stretched out for the whole day. "Okay, guys," I'd say as soon as I counted the last bag, "we take the rest of the day off." They loved it and worked with a joyful playfulness. Their best moments came when we'd be hauling ourselves into the Department of Transportation by 9, just as the other crews were getting started. "You guys gonna work today?" one of my guys would yell. "Man, not much trash out there today," another would say. "Superman and his hot shots have cleaned up most of it. Hope you don't get sunburned out there," they yelled as a truck pulled out. Obviously, the supervisors knew what I was doing, because they saw us coming back in, and they certainly had reports of our going out early. They never said anything. If they had, all I would have had to do was produce evidence of our work. We weren't supposed to work that way, because the rules set the specific work hours, yet not one supervisor ever commented on what I was doing with my crew. More than anything else, I believe they kept silent because we were getting the job done and doing it faster and better than any of the other crews. Some people are born to work, and others are pushed into it by their moms. But doing what must be done as quickly and as well as possible has been my strategy for everything, including medicine. We don't necessarily have to play by the strict rules if we can find a way that works better, as long as it's reasonable and doesn't hurt anybody. Someone told me that creativity is just learning to do something with a different perspective. So maybe that's what it is, being creative. The following summer, after my second year of college, I came back to Detroit to work again as a supervisor with my road crew. At the end of the previous year, Carl Seufert, the top man in the Department of Transportation, had left me with the words, "Come on back next summer. We'll have a place for you." However, the economy hit a slump in the summer of 71, especially in the capital of the automobile industry. Supervisory positions, because they paid well, were incredibly hard to get. Most of the college students who got those jobs had significant personal or political connections. They had been hired months in advance while I was still in New Haven. Since Carl Seufert had promised me a job, I didn't consider confirming it during the Christmas vacation period. When I applied in late May, the personnel director said, "I'm sorry, those jobs are all gone." She explained the situation of few jobs and more applicants, but I already knew that. I didn't blame that woman, and I knew arguing with her wouldn't get me anywhere. I should have put in my application earlier like the others. But I confidently reasoned that I had worked every summer and I would find another job easily enough. I was wrong. Like hundreds of college students, I found that there were absolutely no jobs anywhere. I beat the streets for 2 weeks. Each morning I'd get on the bus, ride downtown, and apply at every business establishment I came across. "Sorry, no jobs." I must have heard that statement or variations of it 100 times. Sometimes I heard genuine sympathy in the voice that said it. At other places, I felt as if I was number 8,000 to come in, and the person was tired of repeating the same thing and just wished we'd all go away. In the middle of this depressing search for employment, Ward Randall Jr. was a bright light in my life. Ward, a white attorney in the Detroit area, had graduated from Yale 2 decades before me. We met at a local alumni meeting while I was still a student. He took a liking to me because we both shared a keen interest in classical music. During the summer of 1971, when I was searching for a job in downtown Detroit, we frequently met for lunch and then went to the noonday concerts. Many of them were organ concerts in one of the churches downtown. Besides that, Ward frequently invited me to go with his family to various concerts and symphonies, and he introduced me to a lot of the cultural interests around Detroit that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to attend because of my lack of finances. He was just a real nice man, a real encouragement to me, and I still appreciate him today. After walking all over the city, I finally decided, I'm going to make up my own rules on this one. I've tried all the conventional ways of finding a job and found nothing, nothing, nothing. Then I remembered my regional interview for entrance into Yale and the person who had interviewed me, a nice man named Mr. Standart. He was also the vice president of Young and Rubicam Advertising, one of the large national advertising companies. First, I tried the personnel office of his company and received the familiar words, "I'm sorry, we have no temporary jobs available." Casting aside my pride and giving myself another pep talk, I got on the elevator to the executive suites. Because Mr. Standart had interviewed me for Yale and given me a fine recommendation, I figured he must have had a good opinion of me. But I hadn't figured out how I'd get past his secretary. I remembered that nobody, absolutely nobody, got into his office without an appointment. Then I figured, what have I got to lose? When Mr. Standart's secretary looked up at me, I said, "My name is Ben Carson. I'm a student from Yale, and I'd like to see Mr. Standart for just a minute. I'll see if he's free." She went into his office, and a minute later, Mr. Standart himself came out. He smiled, and his eyes met mine as he held out his hand. "Nice of you to come by and see me," he said. "How are things going for you at Yale?" As soon as we finished the formalities, I said, "Mr. Standart, I need a job. I'm having a terrible time trying to find work. I've been out every day for 2 weeks, and I can't find a thing. Is that right? Did you try personnel here? No jobs here either, I said. We'll just have to see what we can do. Mr. Standard picked up the phone and punched a couple of numbers while I looked around his mammoth office. It was exactly like the fabulous sets of executive suites I'd seen on television. I didn't hear the name of the person he talked to, but I heard the rest of his words. I'm sending a young man down to your office. His name is Ben Carson. Find a job for him. Just that. Not given as a harsh command, but as a simple directive from the kind of man who had the authority to issue that kind of order. After thanking Mr. Standard, I went back to the personnel office. This time, the director of personnel himself talked to me. We don't need anybody, but we can put you in the mailroom. Anything, I just need a job for the rest of the summer. The job turned out to be a lot of fun because I got to drive all around the city, delivering and picking up letters and packages. I had only one problem. The job just didn't pay enough for me to save anything for school. After 3 weeks, I took my next step of action. I decided that I had to quit my job and find one that paid better. After all, I said to reinforce my decision, it worked with Mr. Standart. I went to the Department of Transportation and talked to Carl Seufert. We were already nearing the end of June. Every job was filled, and it seemed pretty audacious for me to try, but I did it anyway. I went directly to Mr. Seufert's office, and he had time to talk to me. After he heard my summer's tale, he said, Ben, for a guy like you, there's always a job. He was the overall supervisor of the highway construction crews, both cleanup and highway maintenance. Since the supervisory jobs are all gone, he said, we'll make a job. He paused and thought for a few seconds and said, we'll just set up another crew and give you a job. That's exactly what Mr. Seufert did. By using creativity and a little daring, I got my old job back. I used the same tactics with my new 6-member crew, and it worked as effectively as it had the previous summer. Frequently I'd see Carl Seufert when I checked out, or he'd visit us on the worksite. He'd always take time to chat with me. Ben, he said to me more than once, you're a good man. We're fortunate to have you. On one occasion, he put his arm on my shoulder and said, you're your own man. You can accomplish anything that you want in the world. As I listened, this man began to sound like my mother, and I loved hearing his words. Ben, you're a talented person, and you can do anything. I believe you're going to do great things. I'm just glad to know you. I've always remembered his words. The following summer, 1972, I worked on the line for Chrysler Motor Company, assembling fender parts. Each day I went to work and concentrated on doing my best. Some may find this hard to believe, but with only 3 months on the job, I received recognition and promotion. Toward the end of the summer, they moved me up to inspect the louvers that go on the back windows of the sporty models. I got to drive some of the cars off the finish line to the place where we parked them for transportation to showrooms. I liked the things I did at Chrysler. And every day there confirmed what I had already believed. That summer, I also learned a valuable lesson, one that I'd never forget. My mother had given me the words of wisdom, but like many kids, I paid little attention. Now I knew from my own experience how right she was. The kind of job doesn't matter. The length of time on the job doesn't matter, for it's true even with a summer job. If you work hard and do your best, you'll be recognized and move onward. Although said a little differently, my mother had given me the same advice. Benny, it doesn't really matter what color you are. If you're good, you'll be recognized, because people, even if they're prejudiced, are going to want the best. You just have to make being the best your goal in life. I knew she had been right. Lack of money constantly troubled me during my college years, but two experiences during my studies at Yale reminded me that God cared and would always provide for my needs. First, during my sophomore year, I had very little money. And then, all of a sudden, I had absolutely no money, not even enough to ride the bus back and forth to church. No matter how I viewed the situation, I had no prospects of anything coming in for at least a couple of weeks. That day I walked across the campus alone, bewailing my situation, tired of never having enough money to buy the everyday things I needed, the simple things like toothpaste or stamps. "Lord," I prayed, "please help me. At least give me bus fare to go to church." Although I'd been walking aimlessly, I looked up and realized I was just outside Battelle Chapel on the old campus. As I approached the bike racks, I looked down. A $10 bill lay crumpled on the ground 3 feet in front of me. "Thank you, God," I said as I picked it up, hardly able to believe that I had the money in my hand. The following year, I hit that same low point again, not 1 cent on me and no expectations for getting any. Naturally, I walked across campus all the way to the chapel, searching for a $10 bill. I found none. Lack of funds wasn't my only worry that day, however. The day before, I'd been informed that the final examination papers in a psychology class, Perceptions 301, were inadvertently burned. I'd taken the exam 2 days earlier, but with the other students, would have to repeat the test. And so I, with about 150 other students, went to the designated auditorium for the repeat exam. As soon as we received the tests, the professor walked out of the classroom. Before I had a chance to read the first question, I heard a loud groan behind me. "Are they kidding?" someone whispered loudly. As I stared at the questions, I couldn't believe them either. They were incredibly difficult, if not impossible. Each of them contained a thread of what we should have known from the course, but they were so intricate that I figured a brilliant psychiatrist might have trouble with some of them. "Forget it," I heard one girl say to another. "Let's go back and study this. We can say we didn't read the notice. Then when they repeat it, we'll be ready." Her friend agreed, and they quietly slipped out of the auditorium. Immediately, three others packed away their papers. Others filtered out. Within 10 minutes after the exam started, we were down to roughly 100. Soon, half the class was gone, and the exodus continued. Not one person turned in the examination before leaving. I kept working away, thinking all the time, how can they expect us to know this stuff? Pausing then to look around, I counted 7 students besides me still going over the test. Within half an hour from the time the examination began, I was the only student left in the room. Like the others, I was tempted to walk out, but I had read the notice, and I couldn't lie and say I hadn't. All the time I wrote my answers, I prayed for God to help me figure out what to put down. I paid no more attention to departing footsteps. Suddenly, the door of the classroom opened noisily, disrupting my flow of thought. As I turned, my gaze met that of the professor. At the same time, I realized no one else was still struggling over the questions. The professor came toward me. With her was a photographer for the Yale Daily News who paused and snapped my picture. "What's going on?" I asked. "A hoax," the teacher said. "We wanted to see who was the most honest student in the class." She smiled again. "And that's you." The professor then did something even better. She handed me a $10 bill. Chapter 10. A Serious Step. "I've always been called Candy," she said, "but my name is Lucinda Rustin." Momentarily I stared, mesmerized by her smile. "Nice to meet you," I replied. She was one of many freshmen I met that day at the Grosse Pointe Country Club. Many of Michigan's wealthiest citizens live in Grosse Pointe, and tourists often come to admire the homes of the Fords and Chryslers. Yale was hosting a freshman reception for new students, and I, along with a number of upperclassmen, attended to welcome students from Michigan. It had meant a lot to me to have some connections when I first went away to college, and I enjoyed meeting and helping the new students whenever I could. Candy was pretty. I remember thinking, "That's one good-looking girl." She had an exuberance about her that I liked. She was bubbly, sort of all over the place, talking to this one and that. She laughed easily, and during the few minutes that we talked, she made me feel good. At 5'7", Candy was about half a foot shorter than I am, her hair fluffed around her face in the popular afro style, but most of all, I was drawn to her effervescent personality. Maybe because I tend to be quiet and introspective, and she was so outgoing and friendly, I admired her from the start. At Yale, mutual friends often said, "Ben, you ought to get together with Candy." I later found out that friends would say to her, "Candy, you and Ben Carson ought to get together. You just seem right together." Though I was beginning my third year of college when we met, I definitely wasn't ready for love. With my lack of finances, my single-minded goal to become a doctor, and the long years of study and internship that I faced, falling in love was the last thing on my mind. I'd come too far to get sidetracked by romance. Another factor entered into the picture, too. I'm rather shy and hadn't done much dating. I'd gone out with small groups, dated now and then, but had never gotten into any serious relationship, and I didn't plan on any either. Once school began, I saw Candy occasionally since we were both in the pre-med program. "Hi," I'd call out. "How are you doing in your classes?" "Fantastic," she'd usually say. "You adjusting all right then?" I asked the first time. "I think I'm going to get straight A's." As we chatted, I'd think, this girl must be really smart. And she was. I was even more amazed when I learned that she played violin in the Yale Symphony and Bach Society. Not a position for just anybody who could play an instrument. These folks were top-grade musicians. As the weeks and months passed by, I learned more and more intriguing things about Candy Rustin. The fact that she was musically talented and knew classical music gave us something to talk about as we'd pass from time to time on campus. However, Candy was just another student, a nice person, and I didn't have any particularly warm feelings toward her. Or perhaps, with my head in my books and my sights set on medical school, I wouldn't let myself consider how I really felt about the bright and talented Candy Rustin. About the time Candy and I started talking more often and for longer periods, the church in New Haven, which I attended, needed an organist. I had mentioned our choir director, Aubrey Tompkins, to Candy several times because he was an important part of my life. After I joined the church choir, Aubrey would come by and pick me up on Friday evenings for rehearsal. During my second year, my roommate, Larry Harris, who was also an Adventist, joined the choir. Often on Saturday nights, Aubrey took Larry and me to his home, and we got to know his family well. At other times, he showed us the sights of New Haven. An opera buff, Aubrey invited me several times to go with him on Saturday nights to the Metropolitan Opera in New York. "Say, Candy," I told her one day, "I just thought of something. You're a musician. Our church needs an organist. What do you think? Would you be interested in the job? They pay the organist, but I don't know how much." She didn't even hesitate. "Sure," she said. "I'd like to try it." Then I paused with a sudden thought. "Do you think you could play the music? Aubrey gives us some difficult stuff." "I can probably play anything with practice." So I told Aubrey Tompkins about Candy. "Fantastic," he responded. "Have her come for an audition." Candy came to the next choir rehearsal and played the large electric organ. She played well, and I was happy just to see her up there. But the violin was her instrument. She could play anything written for the violin, and although Candy had played the organ for her high school baccalaureate service, she hadn't had much of an opportunity to keep in practice. She had no idea that Aubrey Tompkins liked to throw us into the heavy stuff, particularly Mozart, and she wasn't quite up to it on the organ. Aubrey let her play a few minutes, then he said kindly, "Look, dear, why don't you sing in the choir?" She could have had her feelings hurt, but Candy had enough self-confidence to take it in stride. A master on the violin, the organ wasn't her principal instrument. "All right," she said. "I guess I'm not so hot on the organ." So Candy walked over to where we were singing and joined in. She had a lovely alto voice, and I was delighted when she joined us. She was a real addition to the choir. Everyone loved her from that first night, and, because she liked singing with us, Mount Zion became Candy's church, too, from then on. She wasn't overly religious, didn't talk much about spiritual or religious things, and had no significant biblical background, but she was open and ready to learn. After Candy started attending our church, she enrolled in special Bible classes that lasted from autumn to spring. I used to go with her one or two nights each week, learning a great deal about the Bible myself and enjoying her company at the same time. As Candy reflects on her spiritual journey, she says she always seemed to have a hunger for God. But what made it different for her in the Adventist church?
The people, she says.
They loved me into the faith. Her family thought it was strange for her to join with Christians who went to church on Saturday, yet eventually, they not only accepted her decision, but Candy's mother became an active Adventist herself. Candy and I soon fell into the habit of meeting each other after class. We walked across campus together or occasionally went into New Haven. I was beginning to like Candy a lot. Just before Thanksgiving of 1972, when I was in my final year at Yale and Candy was a sophomore, the admissions office paid our way to do recruiting in the high schools in the Detroit area. They provided us with an expense account, so I rented a little Pinto, and with our extra money we were able to eat in several nice restaurants. It was just the two of us, and we had a wonderful time. We spent a lot of time together, and the reality slowly came to me that I liked Candy quite a lot. More than I'd been aware of, more than I'd ever liked a girl. Yale had recruited Candy and me to interview students who had combined SATs of at least 1,200. After going to all the inner-city schools in Detroit, we didn't find one student who had a combined SAT score to reach that total. To interview any students, Candy and I had to visit places in the more affluent communities like Bloomfield Hills and Grosse Pointe. We found plenty of students to interview who wanted to talk about attending Yale, but we didn't recruit any minorities. On the trip, Candy met my mother and some of my friends. Consequently, we ended up staying a little longer in Detroit than I had planned. I needed to have the rented Pinto back at the agency by 8 o'clock the next morning. That meant we had to drive straight through from Detroit. The weather had been cold. A light snow had fallen the day before, although most of it had melted. Since leaving Yale 10 days earlier, I hadn't once had an adequate night's sleep because of our work and wanting to spend time with friends.
I don't know if I can stay awake, I told Candy with a yawn.
Most of the driving would be on the interstate highways, which makes driving monotonous. Candy and I later disagreed on how she answered. I thought she said something like,
"Don't worry, Ben. I'll keep you awake."
She hadn't had any more sleep than I had. She says her words were, "Don't worry, Ben. You'll stay awake." We started back to Connecticut. Back then, the speed limit was 70 miles per hour, but I must have been hitting close to 90. And what could be more boring to my sleep-starved body than watching endless median marks flashing by on a dark, moonless night? By the time I crossed the line into Ohio, Candy had drifted off to sleep, and I didn't have the heart to awaken her. Though we'd had a wonderful time, the days away from school had been hard on both of us, and I figured that maybe she'd rest a couple of hours, then be fully awake and take over the wheel. About 1 a.m, I was zooming along Interstate 80 and recall passing a sign that indicated we were nearing Youngstown, Ohio. With my hands relaxed on the wheel, the car flew along at 90 miles per hour. The heater, turned on low, kept us comfortably warm. It had been half an hour or more since I'd seen another vehicle. I felt relaxed, everything under control. Then I floated into a comfortable sleep, too. The vibration of the car striking the metal illuminators that separate each lane jarred me into consciousness. My eyes popped open as the front tire struck the gravel shoulder. The Pinto veered off the road, the headlights streaming into the blackness of a deep ravine. I yanked my foot off the gas pedal, grabbed the steering wheel, and fiercely jerked to the left. In those action-packed seconds, my life flashed before my eyes. I'd heard people say that a slow-motion review of life tumbles through the mind just before one dies. This is a prelude to death, I thought. I'm going to die. A panorama of experiences from early childhood to the present rolled across my mind. This is it. This is the end. The words kept rumbling through my head. Going at that speed, the car should have flipped over. But a strange thing happened. Because of my overcorrection with the steering wheel, the car went into a crazy spin around and around like a top. I released the wheel, my mind fully concentrating on being ready to die. Abruptly, the Pinto stopped, in the middle of the lane next to the shoulder, headed in the right direction, the engine still running. Hardly aware of what I was doing, my shaking hands slowly turned the wheel and pulled the car off onto the shoulder. A heartbeat later,
An 18-wheeler transport came barreling through on that lane. I cut off the ignition and sat quietly, trying to breathe normally again. My heart felt as if it were racing at 200 beats a minute. I'm alive, I kept repeating. Praise the Lord, I can't believe it, but I'm alive. Thank you, God, I know you've saved our lives. Candy must have really been tired, for she'd slept through the whole terrible experience. My voice reached inside her sleep, though, and she opened her eyes.
Why are we parked here? Anything wrong with the car?
Nothing's wrong, I said. Go back to sleep. There must have been an edge to my voice, for she said,
Don't be like that, Ben. I'm sorry I fell asleep. I didn't mean to.
I took a deep breath. Everything's fine, I said, and smiled at her through the darkness.
Everything can't be fine if we're not moving. What's going on? Why are we stopped?
I leaned forward and flipped on the ignition.
Oh, just a quick rest,
I said casually, as I began to accelerate and pull onto the road.
Ben, please.
With a mixture of fear and relief, I let the car come to a stop far onto the road's shoulder and turned off the key.
Okay,
I sighed. I fell asleep back there. My heart still pounded. My muscles were tense as I told her what happened. I thought we were going to die, I concluded. I could hardly say the last words aloud. Candy reached across the seat and put her hand in mine.
The Lord spared our lives. He's got plans for us.
I know, I said, feeling just as certain of that fact as she did. Neither of us slept the rest of the trip. We talked the whole time, the words flowing naturally between us. At one point, Candy said,
Ben, why are you always so nice to me? Like tonight, I did go to sleep when I probably should have stayed awake and talked to you.
Well, I'm just a nice guy.
It's more than that, Ben.
Oh, I like being nice to second-year Yale students.
Ben, be serious.
The first brush of violet painted the horizon. I looked straight ahead, both hands on the wheel. Something unfamiliar fluttered in my chest as Candy persisted.
Why?
It was hard to stop joking, hard to let the mask fall away and say the actual words.
I guess, I said, it's because I like you.
I guess I like you a lot.
I like you a lot too, Ben. More than anybody else I've ever met.
I didn't answer, but let the car slow down, eased it off the road, and stopped. It took only a moment to put my arms around Candy and kiss her. It was our first kiss. Somehow I knew she'd kiss me back. We were two naive kids, and neither of us knew much about dating or carrying on a romance, but we both understood one thing. We loved each other. From then on, Candy and I were inseparable, spending every possible minute together. Oddly enough, our growing relationship didn't detract me from my studies. Having Candy at my side, always encouraging me, made me just that more determined to work hard. Candy didn't shirk her studies either. She was a triple major, carrying enough courses for music, psychology, and pre-med. Subsequently, she dropped the pre-med to concentrate more on her music. Candy is one of the brightest people I know, good at whatever she does. It came as no surprise to me that during her senior year with the Yale Symphony Orchestra, Candy performed in the European premiere of the modern opera, Mass, by the gifted Leonard Bernstein. She actually had a chance to meet him in Vienna. One problem that bothered many in the pre-med program was getting into medical school after graduation. The system for medical training requires students to spend 4 years earning an undergraduate degree and then, if accepted by a medical school, to undergo another 4 years of intensive training. If I don't make it into med school, one of my classmates said several times, I've just been wasting all this time. I don't know if I'll get in at Stanford, one pre-med said to me after he'd sent in his application. Or anywhere else, he added. Another mentioned a different school, but the students' worries were essentially the same. I seldom got involved in what I called freaking out, but
This kind of talk happened often, especially during our senior year. One time when this freaking out was going on and I didn't enter in, one of my friends turned to me. "Carson, aren't you worried?"
"No," I said. "I'm going to the University of Michigan Medical School."
"How can you be so sure?"
"It's real simple. My father owns the university."
"Did you hear that?"
he yelled at one of the others.
"Carson's old man owns the University of Michigan."
Several students were impressed, and understandably, because they came from extremely wealthy homes. Their parents owned great industries. Actually, I had been teasing, and maybe it wasn't playing fair. As a Christian, I believe that God, my heavenly Father, not only created the universe, but he controls it. And by extension, God owns the University of Michigan, and everything else. I never did explain. After graduating in 1973 from Yale, I ended up with a fairly respectable grade point average, although far from the top of the class. But I knew I had done my best and put forth the maximum effort. I was satisfied. Aside from my joking, I had no doubts about being accepted at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, in their School of Medicine. I applied there, and since I had believed so strongly that God wanted me to be a doctor, I had no doubts about being accepted. Several of my friends wrote to half a dozen medical schools, hoping one would accept them. For two reasons, I applied there and to only a few others. First, the University of Michigan was in my home state, which meant much lower school expenses for the next 4 years. Second, U of M had the reputation for being one of the top schools in the nation. I had also applied to Johns Hopkins, Yale's medical school, Michigan State, and Wayne State. My acceptance from U of M came extremely early, so I immediately withdrew from the others. Candy still had 2 years of schooling at Yale when I began medical school, but we found ways to bridge time and space. We wrote to each other every single day. Even today, both of us have boxes of love letters we saved. When we could afford to, we used the telephone. One time I called her at Yale, and I don't know what happened, but neither of us seemed to be able to stop talking. Maybe we were both extra lonely, maybe we'd both been having a hard time, maybe we just needed to be together to keep contact when our lives were so far apart. Anyway, we talked for 6 straight hours. At the time, I didn't care. I loved Candy, and every second on the telephone was precious. The next day, I began to worry about paying the telephone bill. In one letter, I joked about having to make payments all through my medical career. I wondered what the telephone company could do to a poor medical student who had even less sense than money. I kept waiting and dreading the day when I actually saw the bill. Strangely enough, the 6-hour call never came through. I couldn't have paid it anyway, certainly not the whole amount, so I confess I didn't investigate the reason. As Candy and I talked it over later, we theorized that the phone company looked at the charges and some executive decided that no one could possibly talk that long. The summer between college graduation and medical school found me back to my old routine of hunting a job, and, as I had experienced before, I couldn't find any employment. This time, I had started making contacts in the spring, 3 months before graduation. But Detroit was in the middle of an economic depression, and many employers said, "Hire you? Right now we're laying off people." At that time, my mother was caring for the children of the Sennett family. Mr. Sennett was the president of Sennett Steel. After hearing my sad tales, Mother told her employer about me. "He needs a job real bad," she said. "Is there any way you could help him?"
"Sure," he said. "I'd be happy to give your son a job. Send him over."
He hired me. I was the only one at Sennett Steel with a summer job. To my surprise, my foreman taught me how to operate the crane, a very responsible job, for it involved picking up stacks of steel weighing several tons. Whether he realized it or not, the operator had to have an understanding of physics to be able to visualize what he was doing as he moved the boom over and down to the steel. The immense stacks of steel had to be picked up in a certain way to prevent the bundles from swinging. Then the operator worked the crane to carry the steel over and into trucks that were parked in an extremely narrow space. Somewhere during that period of time, I became acutely aware of an unusual ability, a divine gift, I believe, of extraordinary eye and hand coordination.
It's my belief that God gives us all gifts, special abilities that we have the privilege of developing, to help us serve Him and humanity. And the gift of eye and hand coordination has been an invaluable asset in surgery. This gift goes beyond eye-hand coordination, encompassing the ability to understand physical relationships, to think in three dimensions.